Welcome to the Lou Catino Show, where we can learn to reimagine our lifestyle.
Dr. Frank Lipman, thank you and welcome to our show. Just a little bit about our show. Our show is here with one intention, to empower people with information, knowledge, science, experience from experts like you. And then people make their decisions to enhance their lifestyle, understand what they're doing wrong, start embracing changes that can be right for their overall health. And none better than you, Dr. Frank. I've been following you for years because you've been practicing for 40 years. I've been practicing for just 9 years. So I've always looked up to the information that you share, the knowledge and experience that you share, because I know your journey. You started off as a medical doctor. You still are. But then it always fascinates me, especially in the United States of America, even though you immigrated from South America to New York, you know, how medical
how you
transition from medicine and integrated with functional medicine, because a lot of doctors out there still like to see a symptom as a symptom and just treat that. So Dr. Frank, why don't you start off by taking us through your journey? Like, what moved you from medicine? What got you into medicine and now functional medicine? And you've created an empire in New York City. And now I hear you're in Dubai as well. So would love to hear your journey and what inspired you to reach where you are today.
Right. So interestingly enough, I came from a medical family. So I automatically went into medicine. I didn't even know what I wanted to do. But in those days, that was, the 70s, 60, I don't know. A long time ago. I'm 68 now. But in those days, I just did medicine because, you know, that's what I, you know, so the smart kids did. That's what my brother did. So I went into medicine. I had no idea I really even wanted to be a doctor. But as soon as I became a doctor, I realized the shortcomings of the system, because in South Africa, I was luckily exposed to not only medicine, but to Sangomas, traditional healers. And I was exposed to different ways. And I saw that, you know, sometimes when we couldn't help the patient and the patient's family would call in a Sangoma, a local traditional healer, they sometimes helped. So it sort of, you know, piqued my interest. And then, you know, soon after, you know, I qualified and I went into a private practice there, I realized the shortcomings of Western medicine. People were coming in and they were tired and they couldn't poop and they had aches and pains, and we had no tools in Western medicine. All I had were drugs that I could give to people. So I realized there were some shortcomings there, and I happened to be working in a very hip practice in Johannesburg. This is the 70s now. He was taking care of a lot of the artists in Johannesburg, and there happened to be one acupuncturist and there happened to be homeopaths, and these patients were coming in and they were saying, well, I went to the acupuncturist and I got better. I went to the homeopath and I got better. So I realized that, you know, Western medicine was, you know, is wonderful at acute care and crisis care, but wasn't very good at treating these day-to-day problems. And so happened that all these traditions that were called quackery by the system I was trained in were actually helping these people. So, you know, it started to pique my interest more and more. And then I emigrated to the United States in 1984 because I just didn't want to live in South Africa under apartheid. And I got a job as an internal medicine resident in New York City. And after a few weeks, I was very, very disillusioned with Western medicine in America, because no one talked to the patient. You didn't spend time with the patient. You just took a quick history. You did all the bloods. You did the EKG and then the X-rays, and you presented the next morning to the professor. It was all about the theory. There was no human aspect. There was no relationship aspect. And that was actually the part of medicine that I enjoyed in South Africa. So I said to my wife, I just don't want to be a doctor here. And there happened to be an acupuncture clinic doing detox in the South Bronx in New York next to my hospital. It was attached to my hospital. So I thought, well, I'm going to check this out. And this is 1984. I went to check out this burnt out building where these people were getting acupuncture for heroin and crack, you know, and crack addiction. And long story short, I fell in love with acupuncture. I started studying acupuncture and Chinese medicine at the same time I was doing my residency. And that was the beginning of the journey because during my residency, I was spending time at the hospital and realizing that Western medicine was wonderful if you had a heart attack or you had acute asthma or you needed antibiotics. And at the same time, I was going to the Chinese medicine clinic and I saw they were helping the patients that we couldn't help, the people who couldn't poop and had back pain and had headaches and were tired. So early on in the 80s, I realized that the future of medicine would be some combination of Western medicine, where we deal with acute crisis care, and Chinese medicine, and where we dealt with other problems. And it started me on this journey of exploring, you know, Chinese medicine and meditation and yoga and herbs and nutrition. And then I discovered functional medicine a couple of years later, which really was articulating from a Western perspective what I was learning in Chinese medicine, what you learn in Ayurvedic medicine. It's all about creating balance and improving function. So that's sort of the short version of my story.
Now that's amazing. And I think you had the strength at that point in New York to make a change. Was it well accepted when you started to practice? What did your colleagues say about it? Because I know a lot of doctors who started practicing functional, they went through a lot of challenges being accepted in their community, or it was very, very difficult for them to establish. But you've taken all of this and you've created your own clinic in Manhattan now. You have your practice going strong. You've seen over thousands of patients. So what were some of the challenges that you faced, doctor?
Well, the initial challenge was, you know, when I was still a resident in New York doing my internal medicine and I was studying Chinese medicine, and they happened to ask me to be chief medical resident in my third year. So I thought it would be great to actually give the staff and the professors a lecture on acupuncture, because they asked me to be chief resident and obviously respected me. And that was the first time I gave a talk on acupuncture, and you know, everyone came up to me and said, "Are you crazy? What are you doing? This is nonsense. You're going to be ostracized." And that sort of made me even realize more that, you know, the system's not going to accept me. If I really believe in this, which I did, you know, I'm going to do it myself. I can't expect to be accepted. You know, the advantages I had were partly, you know, growing up in South Africa, during apartheid, and being, you know, came from a very political family that was against apartheid. So I knew the system was rotten, that, you know, even if people accepted the system, you don't have to believe in the system and you do your own thing. So to me, the medical system was just another system that I saw as not being, you know, an appropriate system. So it was pretty easy for me to say, screw it to everyone, I'm just going to do my own thing, because I knew it was so obvious. It was not a question. I knew what the future would be. I knew that I was seeing people getting better in the acupuncture clinic, seeing people getting better in the hospital, and they were completely different patients. I knew that it was just obvious that the future would be some combination of the two. So it wasn't, you know, I just wasn't prepared to, I didn't really care. So maybe it was easy because I was an immigrant and an outsider anyway, that I didn't really care and I did my own thing. But what was interesting is I got accepted fairly quickly by this alternative world, you know, the artists, the fashion designers, the actors. And so I started creating a practice of people looking for an alternative way of healing. So it was actually, maybe because it was New York, it was pretty easy. There was a big enough population who were interested in what I was doing. And the fact that I was a doctor and you know, doing acupuncture and talking about nutrition actually made it easy. I think people liked the fact that I was trained in Western medicine, and then I was actually bringing what was deemed alternative in those days to the table. So it actually wasn't as difficult as you think. I mean, because I knew what was right. I knew what I wanted to do, so I didn't really, you know, bat an eyelid to all the non-acceptance. I'm still not really accepted in a large way, and I don't really care.
I think what I'm picking up from you, doctor, is that you don't care. You believe in your idea and you just move forward. Because I think if you care at every step of the journey, you probably, it would have been more challenging for you. I think that's a great learning for me as well, to just keep on moving if you believe in a particular idea. So, doctor, you mentioned about the clinics. You mentioned about the, you know, the heroin addiction, crack clinics and acupuncture and Chinese medicine working for that. In your current practice, do you have all of these particular tools working for you and your patients? What's a day in your clinic like, the kind of patients you get, your treatments?
Sure. So, you know, things have changed since COVID because I only go into my office once, maybe twice a week. I do a lot of Zooms, but in my clinic, yeah, we have an acupuncturist, we have a therapist, we have a great physical therapist, nutritionist, I have a nurse practitioner. So we have a lot of different modalities in the clinic. I personally don't do acupuncture anymore. I did acupuncture for 30 odd years. I don't do that anymore. I just do nutrition or functional medicine or anti-aging, whatever you want. I don't know what you, I just practice medicine. I don't really give it a label. So that's what I do. But in the clinic, we have, you know, a lot of great practitioners because, you know, a lot of it is about good practitioners, whatever they bring to the table. So I have wonderful young practitioners. We're actually getting a hyperbaric oxygen chamber soon because I'm quite intrigued by that, actually. So, yeah, we just try to help people in any way we can. And what's happened in my clinic is, you know, I see a lot of people that haven't been helped by traditional medicine. So people who come and see me now, people with chronic digestive problems, chronic autoimmune problems, chronic problems that generally have not been helped by either other functional medicine doctors or generally doctors or by medicine. More and more now, because, you know, I wrote a book on anti-aging, I've become, you know, people sort of know me as a bit of an anti-aging doctor. I'm coming, you know, more and more people are actually coming in when they're younger and want to starting, you know, they want to get their act together earlier on. And, you know, what can they do to stay young and healthy as they grow older? I think that's partly because I wrote the book and partly because of the whole biohacking world. All this anti-aging information and longevity information is sort of getting out there, and people seem to be more and more interested in it. So it's interesting how everything's evolving. I'm not sure what's happening in India, but in New York, it's evolving pretty quickly. People are more and more interested in anti-aging and longevity in particular.
Absolutely, Dr. Frank. In India, it's becoming huge as well. You know, people are more aware. They want to know how to live longer, you know, move away from rapid aging by reducing inflammation, looking at metabolic syndrome. So yeah, there is a lot happening in India right now. And since we're on that topic, I know you wrote a book on that particular subject. So if I had to ask you, what are the top two takeaways from that book, the advice you would give people based on your practice, experience, and science to kind of age gracefully, what would that be?
Well, what I always say is it's the small things that you do on a daily, you know, the ordinary things that we do on a daily basis have an extraordinary effect on our health. So, you know, yes, nutrition is important. You've got to cut back on the sugar in particular and the processed foods. You've got to generally eat less. Sleep is important. Exercise, really important. As we get older, it's strength training as well. But don't forget about the simple things. Being kind to others, for instance, is, you know, being kind to others, being kind to yourself. I think those little things, relationships, you know, really fostering good relationships, those intangibles, I actually have become, you know, I believe now probably even more important. You know, as much as I think, you know, the sleep, diet, exercise, stress reduction, the standard things are really, really important. And picking up diseases early, like heart disease, for instance, which, you know, we can pick up 20, 30, 40 years before it becomes a problem. So all of that stuff is important, but don't forget those ordinary things, you know, being grateful, being kind, not holding on to resentments. You know, these little things are probably as important, if not more important, than the standard things that we think make a big difference.
Dr. Frank, I'm actually smiling while you say this because there are so many longevity experts out there complicating the system. Like you rightly said, and very rarely does someone talk about fulfilling relationships, gratitude, and all of these things. I believe these are the most important things because, you know, I treat patients with cancer and we get to talk a lot to dying patients as well. And when we ask them what was important in life, no one talks about money, no one talks about designation. They talk about relationships which were fulfilling, regret of lost love. I'm happy that you really, really mentioned that because, you know, I have a couple of clients who are 100 years old right now, 101 and 95 years old. And when I speak to them, the commonalities I see are relationships. And many of them have gone through the second and third marriage, but they found fulfillment in every relationship. And the little things that make them happy, some of them have stents in their heart, but they're living happily. And I believe sleep is important, nutrition, like you said, but I really think fulfillment and, you know, deep relationships is what really cuts it at the end of the day. So thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I think, you know, as you say, too many people don't talk enough about that. And that is, to me, the key. Not that I ignore everything else. I think everything else is important, but don't ignore. You can't ignore those intangibles.
Absolutely. Doctor, we'll talk about your other book as well. I know you wrote one on sleep, and that fascinates me because for me, sleep is that foundational pillar of healing, recovery, rejuvenation. So what made you write this particular book? You took sleep as a vertical and you put all of your research and experience into it. What made you write this particular subject?
It's an interesting story. I wrote it because actually a friend of mine, Neil Parikh, who was one of the founders of Casper here, it was a mattress company, and he was a patient and he asked me to consult for the company. He was involved with K, he's not involved there, and he is one of the founders of this huge mattress company which changed the whole mattress system here in the States. He wanted to change his company into a sleep company, and he asked me to be a consultant, and it was an area I mean, I knew it was important, but I didn't, you know, really know that much about it. So I started delving with him into a lot of the research on sleep. And we decided, you know, we delving so much into this research because he wanted to make his company into a sleep company. And there wasn't a book that we really, you know, liked on sleep. So we thought, well, why don't we just write a book together on sleep? I mean, that's really how it happened. It just sort of happened because we were just delving into all the research and we thought, gee whiz, this is interesting. There's so much research now. Why don't we just put a book together?
That's awesome. So what would three top takeaways to all of the audience and even some of the techniques you use to enhance, you know, people with sleep problems in your practice, what would you share with us?
Well, a couple of important points. You know, I see sleep as sort of a symptom of some, you know, if you're not sleeping, you know, it's a symptom of some other imbalance in the system. So sleep is just a symptom to me. So if someone's not having a problem sleeping, it's usually not what's happening at night, although it could be, but it's usually what's happening during the day. A lot of it is, you know, anxiety and stress, not being able to quiet their mind. So that is important for people to understand. The second thing is sleep is a rhythm. It's key to try go to sleep and wake up at approximately the same time every day. So getting consistency and getting your sleep into a rhythm. So going to sleep, you know, late during the week and then trying to catch up on the weekend is one of the worst things you can do. So just keeping that rhythm. And then also understanding, you know, in terms of rhythm, the day and night and sleep and being awake, you know, sleep, you need to be in a dark, cold place to sleep. So you want, you know, if you can't darken your room completely, you know, just get an eye mask. So you want darkness, you want it to be cold, but the consistency is important. And if you're having a problem sleeping, the first thing to look at is what's going on in your life that could be an issue. You know, I'm all for, you know, we use different supplements to help people sleep. We use CBD, we use all sorts of things to help people sleep, but ultimately looking for why it's happening, as we do in functional medicine, is really important. And it can be the stress, it can be what you're eating, it can be when you're eating, it can be the alcohol in what you're drinking or when you're drinking. So, you know, always look for the whys, because sleep is just a symptom of some underlying issue going on.
Right. So address the root cause of the problem.
Exactly.
And doctor, in your practice, you know, there are a lot of functional medicine doctors who, you know, we've had the privilege of working with around the world because we share common patients. What's your take on melatonin? And some doctors really use therapeutic dosage, large dosages of melatonin. I believe in melatonin and the right dosage, right time and the right reason. What's your take on melatonin and therapeutic large doses of melatonin?
Yeah, it's changed lately. It's I now see melatonin as an anti-aging hormone.
Yeah.
You know, I take 10 milligrams every night, not necessarily for sleep, although it actually has helped my sleep. I take it as an anti-aging hormone. So yes, I think the research is now showing that melatonin goes way beyond, you know, most people think of melatonin to help them sleep. And if you want to do that, you actually don't actually need that higher dose. You know, 1 milligram, 2 milligrams is actually usually more than enough. Some people only need 0.5 milligram, but I'm using melatonin more for anti-aging and all the other benefits it has, and that's where it usually starts at about 10 milligrams. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of melatonin, and you know, that's even changed since I wrote the book. In the book, I talked about melatonin for sleep. I didn't really get into all the other aspects of melatonin, but now, you know, getting into more and more of the research, you know, good dose of melatonin can be helpful for many aspects of your health, in particular for anti-aging. So yes, I agree with you. I've become a big fan of a good dose of melatonin. Yeah.
Yeah. The same here, Dr. Frank, you know, even for our cancer patients,
yes,
even if they sleep well, we put them in melatonin irrespective. And we see a vast difference in their overall recovery. Yeah, with, you know, because I think a lot of the stress, and not just that, it's also categorized medically today in some of the research we were looking at as an anti-cancer vaccine. While the melatonin induces sleep, then it's also doing the job of identifying proliferating cells. It's like literally part of the immune system. So I think that intelligence fascinates me of the human body. So
yeah,
but I would love to dive into your routine. What's your routine, Dr. Frank? You maintain yourself, you fit. You know, tell me about your routine, because part of this whole show is to inspire people, you know, through your example as well, how you live your life, you know, your food, just in general, your food, your sleep, your exercise, your stress. What's your routine like?
So my routine is, and it's not every day, but most days I usually meditate first thing in the morning. I don't eat breakfast. I drink black coffee, so intermittent fast. I usually do time-restricted eating. So I'll probably have my first meal around 11 or 12, depends what time I have dinner. I usually don't eat for 16 hours. So I usually meditate, and then depends if I'm working. I'll go to work or set up. I try to do some exercise at least every second day. If I'm not walking to work, I'll do some weights here before, like this morning, I did some weights before this. So I try meditate and then do some exercise most days a week, and depends where I am and working on vacation, different types of exercise. But usually I've started incorporating strength training in the last few years, but I usually either do that or ride my bike or walk. And then, you know, my diet is generally pretty boring and clean. I used to be, you know, I went from being pescatarian many years ago, or vegetarian, pescatarian, finding out I was pre-diabetic, to more paleo, and then, you know, not worrying about saturated fat, and then finding out from my genes and my apolipoprotein protein B and my heart numbers that saturated fat is not appropriate for me. I'm not saying saturated fat is bad for everyone, but for my genes and heart history, it's bad. So I've gone from a pescatarian diet to a paleo diet, eating lots of saturated fat, to realizing that's not right for me. And now I eat basically a Mediterranean diet, a low carb diet, and lower saturated fat. I'm not I still eat animal protein, but I don't eat full cream yogurt anymore. And that's for me. So everyone, you know, now that I know my, you know, we then genetic tests you can now do that can actually help. So now, you know, now that I'm 68, I follow my numbers a little bit more carefully. And I really target my diet, my patients' diets to what their numbers and what their genes show. So it's evolved over time. So I'm a big believer and not a believer. I know there's not one right diet for everyone. Some people do really well on a vegetarian diet. Some people do very well on a paleo diet. And, you know, it all depends on your genes. So for my genes and my numbers, the diet that I now stick to, which seems to work best for me, is sort of a low carb, low saturated fat diet. And I wouldn't have said that 2 years ago. I would have said just low carb, saturated fat's not a problem. But that's nonsense. You know, now that we know, there's more, we know more information. I got caught up in that saturated fat is not a problem bandwagon, which it's not a problem for a lot of people, but if you've got certain genes and it shows up in your lipid numbers, then it can be a problem. So I've adjusted according to my results.
Yeah, no, thanks for being honest about that. And I think that's part of functional medicine. Everybody's different. We have some bodies that are carb efficient at night, and yeah, they're not carb efficient in the morning, and vice versa. And a lot of people on the high, you know, on the ketogenic diets, their lipids go out of place. And then you need to realize that saturated fats don't suit them. So, you know, I think it's very important that we're looking at the world putting themselves in boxes today of extremes and refusing to change that by understanding bio-individuality and uniqueness. So I'm happy you bring that point out, Doctor. What about stress? How do you handle that? Emotions, stress. You know, what are your coping techniques? What's helped you over the years to evolve?
So one of the best tools I learned that comes from the yoga, you know, I started with yoga because, you know, I have a real monkey mind. And yoga was a game changer for me. I had a wonderful, he's still a close friend, mentor who was actually a direct student of Mr. Iyengar, BKSY Iyengar. He used to go to actually Pune every year. So he was a direct student of Mr. Iyengar, and he became my mentor. So he got me into yoga, which then got me into meditation. And I think one of the best tools I have and have learned over the years was a meditation practice. So he got me into yoga and sort of mindfulness. And then I always struggled with meditation. And then I sort of learned a TM type of meditation. Mm-hmm. Learned a mantra type of meditation, which I found much easier. And that's what I sort of stick to now. And that has been really helpful. So I think that is, you know, a real base of what I, you know, do for the stress. But then, you know, I spend a lot of time with my family. I have a 3-year-old grandson who I'm enamored with and very close with. So I spend a lot of time with him, and he's probably the best stress reduction you can get. So, I don't really hold on to resentments. I don't know. I find, if I didn't do all these things, I think I would be a stress ball. But I think I've learned techniques over the years and ways to deal with it, which make it easier. But I think having good relationships, having some type of practice, whether it's a yoga or meditation, whatever it is, I think is priceless. So I would encourage everyone to sort of try to find something that you can connect with and do. You know, it's unfortunately or fortunately, it's a practice. You can't just do it once a week. You got to do it every day or almost every day, preferably every day, for it to really work. So that's what I do and encourage my patients to do as well.
That's powerful. Thank you for sharing that, Doctor. Doctor, I saw a tweet of yours 2 days ago that fascinated me about the ability to test omega-3. And that really fascinated me because there's so much of information about dosages, vegetarians, non-vegetarians. Can you explain a little bit more about, you know, that topic on the ability to test omega?
Yeah, I think what's interesting now is, and we didn't have this a few years ago, we now have the ability to do, you know, I just put it in my complete heart panel. We have the ability to check a lot of nutrient levels, and in particular, omega-3 levels, which I think are crucial to our health. And a lot of vegetarians in particular, you mentioned, actually have low omega-3s. So now you can actually measure it and then replace it. You know, if people don't want to do fish oil, that, you know, there are vegetarian ways of getting omega-3s in that may be a little bit harder, but you can actually measure omega-3 levels now and optimize health by, you know, just taking some fish oil. So I find that the testing that we can do these days is so much more targeted. We can not only, you know, apolipoprotein B, for instance, is probably the most important lipid marker. We can test that. I mean, it's the cholesterol level per se is not really helpful, but apolipoprotein B, lipoprotein A, the markers that we can test are so much more specific. And then, you know, the omega-3 levels. I find it fascinating what we can do to sort of optimize people's health. And, you know, 3-4 years ago, I would have said statins, or I would never use a statin. But now what we see when people have very high apolipoprotein B levels, we use very low dose statins, which actually bring it down. So instead of, let's say, a rosuvastatin or Crestor normally is used at 20 or 30, 40 milligrams a day, you know, we use 5 milligrams 3 times a week, and that still brings apolipoprotein B levels down. So I think as you get older, you become less attached to your old belief systems, and you know, I'm not attached to any belief system. I just want to see what works, and if it's a drug that, you know, there's always a benefit risk ratio, and if it's a drug that's going to help someone prevent something more serious, I'll use a drug, you know, usually at a much lower dose if it works. But I'm less attached to old beliefs that I had, that statins were always bad, saturated fat is always good for everyone. So I think now with the ability to measure different markers, and also now I don't know if you have this in India yet, but we can now do angiograms, you know, a benign sort of, there's a test called the Cleerly test. We used to do a calcium score test for the heart, which just picks up calcification in the vessels. Now we can actually do a Cleerly test, which is actually AI behind an angiogram. So you can actually see if someone not only has calcified plaque, but which is not the dangerous plaque, but if they have non-calcified plaque, and if they have soft plaque, which is a dangerous plaque. So I think the testing has become so more sophisticated now that you can really pick up disease processes earlier and earlier and then treat accordingly, sometimes usually with lifestyle, but sometimes if necessary with medication in addition. So I am, you know, sort of gone full circle to, I really believe that we need Western medicine, and the future is Western medicine combined with functional medicine, lifestyle medicine. It's not an either or. That, you know, so anyone who says all Western medicine is bad is, you know, stay clear of them. And everyone who says that all alternative stuff is bad, just as bad. You know, just use whatever is best for your patients.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, back here home in India as well, you know, we'll use medicine as a crutch sometimes until the patients change their lifestyle. And in that process of changing their lifestyle, they mark them down, and the doctors are more than happy to get them off the meds.
Yeah,
you know, there are very powerful things, doctor, that I picked up from you. I mean, a lot of great information, but things that have inspired me is your attitude when you were starting off your career. You didn't care. You believed in an idea and you moved on. And even what you just said is so powerful. You're not attached to any of your belief systems, because that can really limit us as experts. But, you know, things change. And as long as we're willing to change, because everyone's different and it doesn't have to be the same for everyone, that's something really powerful. And I appreciate that. Doctor, 35 years plus, when you look back at your practice and you look back today at health, given the fact we have AI, we have nutritionists, we have functional medicine, we have everything, but yet the statistics of lifestyle disease is only going higher and higher. You know, so with your experience, your patients, where are we going wrong? What are the top two or three or four things where we're going wrong so that we know we can correct?
That's a great question. I think it's harder and harder in this day and age. Look, I'm talking about New York and probably Dubai that I know a little bit, but I'm guessing Mumbai is not that much different, but I'm not sure. I think it's harder and harder in this day and age to stay healthy because of the pressures and the stresses of, you know, people trying to get ahead and, you know, achieving. So they're generally more stressed out. They don't take sleep that seriously. It's harder to eat. It's harder and easier in a way to eat a healthier diet. There's so much crap in the food here anyway. I'm guessing it's similar there. You know, there's so many chemicals, there's so much sugar, there's so much, you know, fast food has made it so much easier for people. People don't want to cook at home. We've lost a lot of those basic, you know, cultural things that, you know, we all had maybe 30, 40 years ago that, you know, home cooking, you know, spending time with the family, relationships, being, you know, moving your body more. Now everything is, you know, you get into your car, you don't have to move as much. You don't, relationships aren't stressed as much because everyone is in their own world. So I think the basics of most culture, and in this day and age, people are more interested in getting ahead, making a lot of money, being, you know, a big deal, whatever it is. I think they've lost the basics, what I think are probably the most important things for health. You know, look at all the viciousness in the culture. You know, it's everywhere. You know, people are just not kind to other people. So I think we've lost an aspect of our souls, of our humanity, which is big. And then we all get caught up in this fast-paced living, which makes it much harder to stay healthy. So I think all of those things are probably factors, because on many levels, it's in a way easier. We have more access to tools to stay healthy. We do have more access to healthier food if you can afford it. I'm not saying if you, but you have to pay attention. You have to, it's an effort. It's much more of an effort. Maybe as I get older, I see it as much more of an effort, but you do have to pay more attention and put more effort into your health than maybe you did in the old days. You know, when I grew up in South Africa, the food didn't have chemicals. You know, you got foods from the local farmers. The foods weren't full of chemicals. The animals weren't injected with hormones. It was just easier to be healthier on some level. And then, you know, family was more important. You spent more time with the family. It was, things have changed a lot. I mean, it's hard for me to say because I'm in the sort of the belly of the beast here in New York City. So, but I'm guessing Mumbai is probably no different. Somewhat different maybe, but probably a lot of the same aspects.
Yeah, what you say is absolutely right. Mumbai is the same. A lot of India is right now. Like, we have the highest counts of diabetes. We're in fact called the diabetic capital of the world. Right. And that follows all the metabolic syndromes, cardiovascular, inflammatory cancers. So we're pretty much in the same boat, doctor. And it's very powerful what you said. You know, things have changed, but we got to work harder and put in more effort if we want to survive in this particular system, you know? So, doctor, I wanted to ask you, out of all of your practice, are there any like cases, one or two, you know, memorable cases which you've treated, which is so, you know, nurturing to you, so motivating to you, where you had the impact of your integrated approach of medicine, functional, alternative, and you were able to bring about healing to that particular patient? We'd love you to touch upon one or two of those cases.
Sure. So, you know, I've seen so many patients over the years, autoimmune. So, you know, two patients come to mind because one was a well-known chef in New York who had severe rheumatoid arthritis, and a lot of he was hospitalized. I mean, he was really, really in bad shape. And like most autoimmune problems, we often, if there's a gut issue, you treat the gut because leaky gut is often the problem. And he just was one of those people. We gave him antiparasitics, antifungals, we did everything. And eventually he reversed his rheumatoid arthritis, and he's now a real jock and healthy and whatever. And I bring that case up because of that, and he spoke about it, I became sort of autoimmune center. Everyone with autoimmune problems would start reaching out to me. So I think autoimmune issues are one of those things that Western medicine doesn't deal well with. And, we in functional medicine can and often do reverse autoimmune problems, and even if they're severe. And I bring that one up because of that particular case, so many autoimmune patients came to me, and they're not always simple. I'm not saying they're simple, but that was just a miraculous recovery. The one that patient that always stands out to me, and I put it in one of my books, I can't remember, was a woman who had chronic fatigue, and we tried everything on her. And eventually I threw up my hands, and she was one of these driven New Yorkers who worked really hard and was just pushing herself and pushing herself. And we just, we tried everything and nothing worked. And eventually I threw up my hands and I said, "Why don't you just leave New York, go to Africa and work for a nonprofit, and do something that is more meaningful for you?" And I didn't hear from her for a while. And I think 6 months or maybe longer later, I got this beautiful email from her saying, "Thank you, Dr. Lipman. I took your advice. I'm in Africa. I'm working for this amazing nonprofit. I love what I do. I feel great. I'm totally healed. Everything is great. Thank you for doing that." And I threw up my hands and, "What the hell do I do with it?" And I sort of in frustration said, "Go work for a nonprofit." And those are the things that I think make, the one story is, yes, you've got to use medicine. And we used antiparasitic drugs. We used antifungal drugs. It's not that we just did, alternative stuff and nutrition and supplements. We used drugs to get rid of the parasites and the fungus he had in his gut. So we actually had to use a combination of Western medicine and Eastern. So we had to use the tools of medicine. And in the other case, it's the things we take for granted. If you find something meaningful, if you find a purpose in your life, you're going to feel much better. So those two stories are a real indication of how the best medicine is using Western medicine with functional or alternative. And then the best medicine also is, being aware of and taking into account the emotional aspects of our health.
That's a beautiful story. So just changing the environment, and the environment healed her. That's exactly
Exactly.
what happened to her. That's beautiful. Doctor, I'm mindful of your time. So before we end this, if you had the attention of the world on you for about 3 minutes, 4 minutes, the whole world was listening to you, what message would you leave for them with all of your years of medicine, science, experience, and of course the passion that you have within you? What would you tell everyone?
I would tell everyone what I started with. I mean, I think it's important to look after your health. I think how you eat, when you eat, what you eat, who you eat with, how you sleep, moving your body as much as possible, learning ways of dealing with stress, all very, very important. Your relationship is very important to health. But if I have to leave one message, it would be kind to yourself, be kind to others, and be kind to the earth. To me, that if we can get that message out to everyone, just kindness to yourself, kindness to others, kindness to the earth, I think that would be my message.
Dr. Frank, this has been amazing. And if people want to reach out to you, what's the best way they can reach out to you? We know where your books are available, but how do people reach out if they want to consult with you or your team?
Yeah, just my website, drfranklippmann.com, drfranklippmann.com. And then there must be some way, there are ways there that people get to me, because I think there's my office and they email, because we get emails from around the world all the time. So I'm not sure exactly, but I know on the website there's ways of getting in touch with us.
Stay tuned for more. We're going to continue our journey, learning, sharing, and evolving.